Commission does have control over anything that happens to PGE, for example. There are other state mandates, such as injunctions. We go in and make sure that the debtors abide by those injunctions. We also protect bonds that may be pledged in order to perform, such as construction contractor bonds, to make sure that they're not property of the state, that they are paid to the state. And then one area is we object to discharge in many matters, and this primarily is in the support enforcement area. Debtors in bankruptcy will try to discharge their support obligations, and we represent the state in enforcing that and making sure that the support orders are not discharged. This section prides itself in and has as a goal the maximum recovery at a minimum cost. And this refers back to a performance measure that I'll talk about towards the end of my presentation. We do have a performance measure on this. It's 137-8. Generally, this section does recover $8 for every $1 spent by the state. There are two types of caseloads in this section, a standardized caseload and a time-intense caseload. The standardized caseload is one that we have for various client agencies that we use forms, intense use of forms, and intense use of legal assistants and paralegals. One I would like to highlight is the Oregon Department of Transportation. We handle prosecute all of the damage claims that ODOT has. People run into guardrails, lamp posts, whatever throughout the state. These come out of district dedicated funds, and we have a recovery program to recover from those people who do damage to the state's property in order to replenish those funds. We have a paralegal and a legal assistant in that unit, and we bring in between $1.5 to $1.7 million per year. And in that particular section, we recover $10 for every $1 spent in prosecuting those actions. The other type of case that we involve, besides the standardized cases that are heavy legal assistant, paralegal oriented, are time-intensive cases. The best example of that recently is on behalf of the Division of State Lands, we sued the owners and operators of the new Carissa that landed on the beach down south. That was litigation that took almost 2 years, ended in an 8-week trial. We have a judgment for $25 million and presently on appeal. That involved a lot of attorney time, also a lot of paralegal time. Very much time-intensive, different than our standardized caseload. This section is primarily located in Salem, although we have two attorneys up in Portland and a support staff. They handle the vast volume of bankruptcies, which are up in the Portland section of the bankruptcy court. Next slide shows the actual monies received by Biennia by this section. And when I mean actual money received, these are actual greenbacks that come into the Treasury, not judgments or not anything else. Generally, the section has brought in between $20 and $25 million per biennium. This last biennium, we have, at least for the 18-month period of time of the biennium, it's around $10 million. A lot of that was because the time-intensive nature and lengthy nature of the new Carissa litigation that actually should be, since we did win that case and the money is in our client trust account, that could be $35 million, but since it is still on appeal and the state hasn't truly received that money, it's a lesser amount. But there is an explanation for lesser recovery.
Can I ask you to make a distinction between how, like, the new Carissa case would end up in the trial in your division versus the trial division? Is the trial division predominantly defense, you're predominantly offense? Is that how you would break it up?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Okay.
The trial division is, in essence, a insurance defense firm, and we are, in essence, a plaintiff's litigation firm.
Got it.
We go after the money. We stress efficiency and effectiveness in this particular section. A lot of automated forms, a lot of use of legal assistance. We do have educational seminars. We try and not only push the work down to the lowest possible level, we also try and push the work out to the agencies. We just concluded an educational seminar on bankruptcies for all the state agencies. Because of the economic climate, bankruptcies are going up, and we are training people in the agencies to handle their own proofs of claim and to recognize at what point in time we need to call a bankruptcy expert and at what point in time they can prosecute their own claims. We have designed through the years collection programs for the state agencies. In about 10 years ago, this section was predominantly a collection section. Over the years, what we've done is transferred that out to the state agencies. We do have one revenue agent that handles more complex collection work, but almost all of that has been pushed out into our client agencies, and we have seminars, and we design their forms and help them along there. One other aspect of Chairman, you were discussing with Mr. Arnold yesterday about the contracts. We do a lot of suits for on contracts for breach of contract with the state. And ever since about the mid-90s, when we were handling the DMV computer case, we've been working with the business transaction sections. And when we run across particular problems and problems in wording of a state contract, we will tell the business transaction section so that they can work with the form and kind of in the trenches what we're seeing, they can correct whatever problems that we're seeing out there. Both Don and I were discussing after yesterday's session that anecdotally we are seeing fewer and fewer contract cases coming through, and such that they are, they're better. We used to have mushy contracts, and now they're firmer, and we have a better chance of prevailing. The trends in civil recovery section are up there. A big trend is that bankruptcies are going up, and they're going up by about 10 to 20% per year. In 2001, there were 23,000 bankruptcies filed in the District of Oregon. Through September of 2002, there were 24,000. They're going up, they're going up. We have presently about 200 bankruptcy cases in this particular unit. They range from anything from handling someone who is trying to discharge a state obligation in child support to the Enron bankruptcy to the WorldCom bankruptcy. And we're there protecting the state's interest. Bad economic times, that's what happens. Also, we are seeing an increase in loan defaults also, and that this section will prosecute. We have a policy package that is associated with this section, and it is part of the state's obligation under the Master Settlement Agreement to enforce our non-participating manufacturer statute, which is in ORS 293. If you would like, I could go into the basis of what this is, but I think I'll operate under the assumption that the committee does have an understanding of the Master Settlement Agreement and the obligation of the state to enforce the non-participating manufacturer statute in order to continue the stream of income to the state. This is these three FTE will be billed to the Master Settlement Asset Corporation that is being set up to sell the bonds that that are based upon the stream of income. This is what we project, what has been needed and what will be needed in the future in order to protect the stream of income. I would like next to turn to the charitable activities section of the Civil Enforcement Division. The Attorney General has two charges in the charitable area: to regulate charitable organizations and to regulate charitable fundraising. The mission statement for the charities program is basically to keep Oregon a safe place to give to charities. There are some of the ways in which the section does that. in the gaming area, which is the professional fundraising for charities, the mission is basically to keep charitable fundraising honest and fair in the state of Oregon. How does this section do that? How do we accomplish those missions? The first way is through a registration and licensing program. We collect information on the various fundraisers and on the various charitable operations. We do background checks on the fundraisers, and then we make this information available to the public. The public can come into our offices, and the public does on a frequent basis come into our office and peruse the registrations. In addition, the section has a web page in which certain specific information about charitable organizations is posted on this web page. Last biennium, or through this biennium, we've had 113,000 hits on this web page. And it will have, the purpose of the web page is so that people can have more informed giving. So, for example, we will have the charity's name. We'll have what percentage of that charity's of a dollar for that charity goes to overhead, what percent goes actually out to an organization or to a charitable purpose. It will list all of the charitable purposes of that organization and how much money is spent in each of those particular areas. So if a person is considering giving, they can get on their computer, click on that, and get a fairly decent snapshot of a particular charity. In addition, we...
How many other states provide that service for their citizens? Is this unique to Oregon, or what's the status there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I honestly don't know, but I can check that out for you.
Thank you.
How many charitable organizations do you have listing and
We'll soon have a handy-dandy slide on that, but...
When you get to it, you get to it.
In order to enforce the mission, we enforce egregious violations of the statute, and we have an educational mission. Some of what we've done in enforcement, that we all probably have taken telephone calls from people saying that they represent the Sheriff's Association of a particular county, and that they want us to buy circus tickets or whatever. We just finished prosecuting a case here in Marion County where people were calling up saying they represented the Marion County Sheriff's Department and wanted to sell tickets. They, in fact, had no connection whatsoever to the Sheriff's Department, and we successfully closed them down. In addition, another area that is a growing area for this section is that nonprofit foundations, primarily hospitals, will often be purchased by for-profit operations, and the Attorney General ensures that a certain amount of assets do stay in the charitable realm in order to continue on with that charitable purpose. The program funding is completely fee-supported. There are absolutely no general fund dollars. The fees are paid by the registrants or the licensees. And predominantly, their fee schedules are tied to how much their organization makes. I'd like to also emphasize that the current fee schedule is adequate. This section is located in Portland.
Representative Hanson.
I could interrupt with one question. When you say the totally fee supported, does that also cover overhead costs and administrative costs within the department, or does that just cover the cost of the service that you're actually delivering through the department?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanson, I believe that covers everything.
Mr. Chair, there is a cost allocation plan the department runs, so programs like this, which are fee-driven, you know, the Attorney General's salary and all the admin salaries are part of that cost allocation.
Okay. Good.
And I believe he's right that there are no general funds in this program being subsidized.
And it does pay everything. One thing I'd like to emphasize about the staffing is the majority of the work is pushed down to the investigator and the registrar level, and under the guidance of attorneys. Here's a chart depicting the fluctuations in the nonprofit gaming workload. This particular workload is it's going down, and it is primarily because of the influence of the lottery and the Indian casinos. So this nonprofit professional fundraising does, for the most part, aim at is in gambling. So we have bingos and Monte Carlo, and the competition that the state provides and the Indian casinos have provided has made this go down and down, and we anticipate it to continue to be reduced. On the other hand, the charitable organizations' workload is increasing. And Mr. Chairman, you can see we have in the year 2002 12,000 or so charitable organizations registered with the department. Why is this increasing? First, the charitable corporations are becoming increasingly popular for various groups that used to operate as loose associations. So an example of this would be parents' groups would get together in order to have safe grad nights for Sprague High School. Well, in the past, it used to be the PTA or just an organization would do it. Nowadays, because of liability issues, they would form a charitable corporation. In addition, charitable foundations are a popular method for estate giving and estate planning. So, especially during the boom years here, the charitable foundations were going up, and then even despite the downturn in the stock market, that does remain a very popular way for people who have any wealth in order to pass on their wealth.
Chair?
Yeah, go ahead.
Do we have information from these auditors that audit these charities to make sure that they are in fact doing exactly what they tell the department that they are doing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we do participate in spot audits of the charities. That is the purpose of the auditors. And I don't believe that every single charity is audited, but we do random check audits.
And what's the nature, Mr. Chair, follow-up?
Please.
What's the nature of those random check audits, and what do they look like? What's their auditor's report look like? Is it a certified audit of some sort? Is it... I guess I come back to my first question. Do we have available to the Ways and Means staff the audits themselves, the audit reports themselves of these agencies, these charitable organizations that are being audited?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, precise format, I believe, can vary because we can do various levels of audit. Number one, the format. Number two, their availability. We have all the audits that are conducted during any period of time. We can certainly make them available to the extent that you wish us to make them available to your staff.
Chair, I just request that we have at least a summary of the audits that are ongoing and what the raw audit results look like. Audit is a depending upon who you're talking to, I guess it's a fairly unique term of art. And if we do have in fact audits going on, I'd like to know what they look like, what the results of those audits are, how many are being conducted in relationship to the 12,000 organizations that are out there, and really the scope and detail of what our auditors are finding.
I'd be more than happy to provide what we have.
What's your case? I mean, this seems like an awful lot of staff based upon the number of charitable organizations, and some of those are probably large charitable organizations who have their own set of auditors and other people who have their companies audited. So can you give us an idea of what the caseload looks like for your attorney and investigative staff in regard to this? I understand it's fee-driven and everything else, but by the same token, when you compare it to some of the other divisions and the volume of cases that they have, it certainly seems pretty substantial. So if you can just give us some of that information.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The attorneys only will, if an investigation, if I can maybe describe how the section works, because when we are on the enforcement side,
right,
the a case will come in usually through either a public complaint or through an audit finding something that's curious. And then it will be investigated by the investigative staff that is supervised by a chief investigator. At that point in time, there will not be any attorneys involved. And
understand well how the process works. I just am interested in what kind of caseload these attorneys and investigators are carrying, and then we can maybe talk more specifically once we have some of that kind of raw data.
I can certainly get that for you. I believe each attorney is handling roughly 50 cases. I do not know what each investigator has, but I can provide that for you.
Okay. I mean, on the cases, is that 50 a year? I mean, what are they clear? I'm interested to know what their intake is and how many cases a year they're clearing. So.
It sounds like, Mr. Chair, you want information like the appeals or trial division provided.
I'd be more than happy to do that.
Thanks.
The next section is the family law section. It has two basic clients, the Department of Human Services, in which it litigates termination of parental rights cases, and the Department of Justice Division of Child Support, which it litigates cases involving paternity and modifying and enforcing support orders. The family law section is the largest section. It is in three sections. It's in Portland, Eugene, and in Salem. Their attorneys cover the whole state, and they're constantly in court throughout the state. The next slide shows our termination of parental rights caseload. This is a caseload that is unfortunately a growth industry. It's primarily driven by the increase of population in Oregon and by the unfortunate increase in drug use, primarily methamphetamine. The next slide.
I thought it was going to be.
The next slide shows.
Based upon the federal. Which would be abstract.
The caseload for the Division of Child Support. The primary area in which the litigation occurs is in support orders. Paternity order or contested paternity cases are actually going down because of science, that the DNA results are becoming so sure that people are choosing not to contest these cases. The modification caseload also is leveling off. It had a bubble there driven by a federally ordered mandate. The support orders and modifications and the establishment of support orders is pretty much a steady diet or a steady caseload for the Division of Child Support. Here are some of the factors impacting caseload. As I said, the main factors in the termination is primarily population increase and drug use. The caseload is also driven by the Department of Child Support policy directions. We are, in this particular section, are reactive to that. Such things, for example, as localization. The Division of Child Support is going out and localizing various areas. Well, our attorneys who normally meet with those caseworkers do have to travel a bit, which increases the time they spend on a case. I'd also like to point out that there is a federal requirement that termination cases be resolved in a speedy period of time. It's 1 year. And that drives the almost constant caseload or trial load that these attorneys have. Next section I would like to speak about is our Medicaid fraud section. There's a federal mandate that every state have a Medicaid fraud control unit, and they handle both criminal and civil investigations and prosecutions into fraud involving Medicaid-funded providers, also physical and financial abuse of long-term care patients. The breakdown is approximately 70% criminal prosecution, 30% civil prosecution. This is another section that is located in Portland, has three attorneys, and the rest of it is primarily an investigative staff. The next slide shows the performance in investigations and indictments and convictions. We are, as we add staff, primarily investigative staff, we are increasing the number of investigations we have. We did have a period of time where we had difficulty with an attorney leaving and the replacement of that attorney. And so we had a rather flattening out of the indictments and convictions. The during the last biennium, Representative Schrader was so good as to push forward a package in which we increased our investigative staff. And so that is reflected in the amount of increased amount of investigations that we have. We anticipate as soon as those investigations move through, we will have increased number of indictments and convictions. The next slide also shows the judgments and collections. In the this biennium, the 18 months of this biennium, there has been recovered or 3,273,000 actually of judgments and collections. This also was influenced somewhat by the turnover in our senior AAG position. When you have three attorneys and you're missing one for a period of time, that does tend to slow things down a little bit.
Sure. Representative Butler.
Just a brief question. Looking at the program performance, and I believe that's on the immediate past slide, Mr. Bossy. The cases under formal investigation for in 2002, 88, cases screened but not opened, 107, and then judgments, indictments, or convictions, 31. To look at the total number of cases that were in process during the year, would I add those three together, or are those exclusive, mutually exclusive, or are they? Could I have a case that was being under investigation and a conviction or indictment in the same year, and add 88 cases? Could part of the 31 cases be in the 88?
Then, yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, yes, that is my understanding of how this does work. You could have a case formally investigated, tried, and then have a person convicted all within the same calendar year.
So do we know the total amount, number of actual cases handled hands-on during any one period? This appears that there could be 200 in this particular, I'd say 200 actions, not necessarily different cases. But I guess then probably the way to do that would be to total up all three of those and call each one of those an action, a case that was under investigation, a case that was screened but not open. I guess that would be under investigation. Are those two exclusive?
Correct.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, if I can withdraw that answer. They are mutually exclusive. I'm sorry. Yes, the 107 is mutually exclusive of
the
88.
The others, because they really didn't come under formal investigation, nor did they generate an indictment.
Correct. Okay. But within the 88, the 31 could be within the 88.
And I'll ask the same question again, Mr. Chair, if I may, relative to the auditors. These auditors that are investigating these fraud cases, They're not auditing an organization. They're auditing someone who is who either a doctor or a patient who is involved in some sort of Medicare fraud or is suspected thereof, I guess. What's the nature of what they do?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, sometimes there will be an organization because of the hospitals, or a doctor will be operating under a PC or some corporate form.
Right. I thought I tried to say that, that it could be an organization that, right. that would be involved. But what's the nature of what an auditor does here? I assume that's a different class of person than an investigator or an investigative auditor.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, I think it would be safest if we could handle this as we are handling the charitable activities auditor question, and I could bring you some samples of what the auditors do and their reports.
Can we talk about your judgments and collections real quick?
Yes.
2001, civil collections, $9.35 million, large case, hospital case. Can you explain?
Yes.
Okay. Just a large jump and an anomaly.
Yes.
Good job, Jeff.
There are various factors affecting service. Some of those are our own success, and that we, the more we prosecute, the higher the profile of the case, and then the more referrals that we get in from various law enforcement agencies. In addition, our educational program is increasing and because of the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act of 1996. We need to educate the people in various district attorney's office. We are, in this group, participating in various interagency and intergovernmental programs. One I would like to focus on is the increased coordination efforts with the Department of Human Services audit staff. In the biennium before, we were receiving in this unit 2 to 3 referrals of Medicaid fraud from the DHS audit staff. There was a reformation or a reorganization within the Department of Human Services and a re-emphasis on auditing. And during this biennium, we received 50 referrals from this group. And we have, I believe, quarterly meetings with the audit staff, so we're working more together with the audit staff at the Department of Human Services.
How much does DHS do when they discover an anomaly? Do they just turn it immediately over to you all, or do they try and do an initial investigation on their own? Do they initiate something on their own?
It's my understanding that they do some form of initial investigation themselves, Mr. Chair, but I don't know to what extent, and if you would wish for me to find that out, I could.
Okay.
Next slide shows the Medicaid fraud funding. It is a 3-to-1 federal match. So for every dollar that the state puts in, we get $3 in program. This next slide shows the historical program growth of the unit. It was founded in 86. Through the years, we have gradually increased the unit. In the 2001-2003, we did add an additional auditor, research analysts, support staff, and investigators. We phased them in through the biennium in order to have the workload increase so that before the Assistant Attorney General was hired.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you're discovering the Medicaid fraud, do you often find other types of welfare fraud that is happening simultaneously, or other types of criminal fraud? If you uncover one kind of problem, sometimes the people that will commit one type of fraud are quite capable of doing this. And is there other monies returned? Assorted things?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I do believe that in certain instances we will find various types of fraud. I know that in certain circumstances this unit will refer cases to the financial fraud section for civil prosecution. They will also refer out various types of cases to the district attorneys within the various counties. They have a very close working relationship with the district attorneys throughout the state. I don't know exactly what the statistics are about whether at what point, how many cases they find other types of fraud, how many times they don't.
How many of your cases are bumped to local DA's offices?
Honestly, I don't know that. We are primarily operate on referrals from district attorney's offices and from the Federal Department of Justice. So it's almost they bump to us.
Well, that was my experience, so I was wondering, like you said, some were bumped back, so I wondered how many were bumped back.
During our investigation, we do find that there is a fraud that is something that we don't handle, we would certainly go back to the DA that referred it to us.
And they call Byron, and Byron handled this case.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator George.
I've been out of Dallas for a speaking engagement, so I feel a little ornery right now, so I'm going to ask this question.
It's in the water out there.
Has anyone ever called and asked about the practice of the legislature to overbill the muffled dollars?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, not that I know of.
Okay. We'll get a phone call.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Devlin.
I hope I didn't miss this portion, but in terms of this being a 3-to-1 federal match, and in terms of your collections and judgments, both civil and criminal, where does the money go back to?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, the money goes back to many different areas. It does go back to the federal government. It does go to the Oregon Health Plan or to DHS. And then if you can look at the slide that shows Medicaid fraud funding. If you look down at the bottom, program income, in certain circumstances, the federal government will allow us to use money that we have recovered in order to set off the 25% that contribution by the state. And we have been fairly lucky that we have been recovered funds through the years in a sufficient amount that the federal government has allowed us to participate in this type of program.
Chairman, follow up. Then other than that amount, though, you would say that in general it's in proportion to where the dollars came from originally in terms of going back, or is it too complex to describe?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, it is very complicated, and that is a general rough rule, but it is fairly complicated. I can provide the committee with the details of that.
Your answer is sufficient.
Can you tell me what the... You have the 0103 budget at the general fund at 178-170, and then you have the governor's balance budget at 424-978. I didn't see a policy option package in here. I'm wondering what the bump is, or did Senator Schrader put the investigators in the last month of the biennium or something? I just wondering what the large jump in general fund money is for.
Mr. Chairman, this was a phased-in package, and I can find that out.
Can you tell me what the package was? Does BAM know? Do you know what the package
was? No, Mr. Chair, I don't know which package. We can find out for you. You're talking about the package that was included last
week. Well, I'm just wondering on a match. I mean, when you jump from 178 to 424, you're more than doubling the amount of state general fund. The staff hasn't
doubled, I don't believe.
No.
So I'm just wondering where the bump is. I mean,
let us find out what package that was and how many folks were added this time, and give you that information and give you some sense of what the roll-up would be to explain that increase in general. So I'd be happy to do that.
Mr. Chairman, I believe 6 positions were added through this biennium. They were phased in.
6 positions?
There were research analysts. Yes, I'm trying to find
5.
Okay.
On the next slide, I believe.
Oops. Is that the next slide? Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you, Artie. At the bottom of the historical program growth, we have auditor, research analyst, support staff, 2 new investigators, and an attorney position.
Well, I guess I'm just wondering that if we're looking at that particular piece, I see that now, and then I'm looking at the number of cases that were either under formal investigation, screened, or indictments, judgments, or convictions going back to the previous program performance slide. I'd be interested in the phase-in when that occurred, because the phase-in, 1, 2, you didn't fill the attorney position, it looks like, there. So you added 1, 2, 3, 4.5 FTE. And you got no appreciable bump, it doesn't look like to me, in cases. So if we could maybe take a look at that particular piece, I would certainly appreciate maybe a little more thorough understanding of, if we give you, you know, what the phase in is, and if we gave you 4.5 staff, what we were anticipating, and it doesn't look like the left hand and the right hand. I mean, maybe you had more initial complaints that you investigated. I just need to know those things to continue to justify that position.
Mr. Chairman, we are preparing a report on this policy package and its effect, and that was one of the budget notes that this division had. That we anticipate that we will have that by the end of the week, and I believe that will address your question.
I can't expect you to answer that flat-footed right now, so if you could get back to us, that's good.
The final slide for this section is comparable states in size of Medicaid budgets. We have our program is right in line, if not slightly smaller than comparable states that have like Medicaid budgets. At this point in time, I would like to turn the floor over to Cheryl Pellegrini, who will talk about the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection section.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini, Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Justice. The mission of the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section, to enforce Oregon's consumer protection laws. The laws that we enforce include the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. That law governs consumer-to-business transactions for personal, family, or household goods, services, or real estate. The law prescribes the types of representations a seller can make about its product, service, or real property. That law is also used to enforce other consumer laws, such as credit repair and laws governing auctions. We also enforce state and federal antitrust provisions that prohibit price fixing, monopolies, and other conduct that restrains trade. And in addition, we are also vested with authority to regulate and enforce Oregon's telemarketer registration laws, laws governing telephone solicitation, unsolicited faxes, and simulated invoices. How do we enforce our laws? First, through education. It's our first line of defense. It's the best method of prevention, and we found that it's consistently more cost-effective than litigation. Our education targets both businesses and consumers. in targeting businesses, our education serves three purposes. First, it fosters cooperation between the business community and the Department of Justice. Second, it provides notice of the responsibilities under Oregon's consumer protection laws, and it provides notice to businesses of the standards that they will be held to. Third, it promotes more effective self-regulation. When we develop education for consumers, again, it accomplishes three purposes. First, we always warn consumers of scams we're finding in the marketplace. Second, our education is targeted to prevent consumers from falling prey to illegal schemes. And third, we teach them to become better reporters of fraud. When education fails or falls on deaf ears, we bring enforcement actions to stop, deter, and punish unlawful conduct. When I say enforcement actions is that we'll initiate an investigation of a business if we find probable cause to believe it has violated a law. Before filing a lawsuit, the Unlawful Trade Practices Act has built into it an alternative dispute resolution mechanism. It requires that we give the opportunity to the business to settle by entering into what's called an assurance of voluntary compliance. It's in the nature of a consent decree. It does not admit liability. It is enforceable. It's filed with the court, and it has all the authority of a court order. I would say about 99% of the cases that we investigate and prosecute resolve through entry of an assurance of voluntary compliance. Otherwise, we file a lawsuit. We file lawsuits on our own in conjunction with other state attorneys general's offices in multi-state cases, or sometimes joint with other state agencies, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. When we resolve our enforcement actions, we seek, and it, to the extent that we're able, to shift to the target of the enforcement action the cost of their unlawful conduct. This serves several purposes. First, the payment is calculated to serve a deterrent function. We usually calculate it in order to make it a little bit more than the cost of their doing business. Second, the payments comprise the other funds that the section uses to pay for our enforcement actions and other activities. Third, those payments return restitution to consumers. In 2001, we returned $3.48 million to consumers. In 2002, we returned $1.7 million to consumers. That's directly back to consumers. That is in addition to monies that we receive in CyPray distributions. Those are they're large settlement amounts that aren't returned to individual consumers. Rather, those settlement amounts are used to set up grant programs to benefit an entire class of consumers. A good example of that is in Toys R Us. It was an antitrust case. It was price fixing. We received $350,000 worth of toys that we distributed over a four-year period through the Toys for Tots program. In addition to that, we received another $160,000, and with that money, we set up grant programs, and we distributed it to nonprofits across the state that ran programs to benefit children. This is who we are. The attorneys, investigators, and paralegals primarily serve a law enforcement function. The consumer information coordinator, her name is Jan Margosian, you're probably all familiar with her. Jan is the link between the enforcement and the education parts of our section. The enforcement officers, I'm going to be talking about them more later on, but the enforcement officers handle each and every individual written complaint that comes into the office. Volunteer, coordinator, volunteers. Those people are the first point of contact for consumers. We have 31 active volunteers that staff our hotline. And what they do is they answer questions, they assist consumers in filling out complaints with our office, and they provide referrals to other law enforcement and state consumer protection agencies. Those 31 volunteers spoke with 60,126 callers last year. Those 31 volunteers in 2002 devoted a total combined amount of time, 4,437 hours they provided to the Department of Justice. If you do the math, that's the equivalent of 2.24 full-time employees. In addition to education, how we accomplish our goals, as I said before, first through education. Jan Margosian is a primary component of our education program. Jan is our media spokesperson and educator. She conducts in-person statewide speaking engagements. In 2002, she conducted 50 speaking engagements. That's about 4 to 5 a month. We also produce educational brochures. There are plastic bags with brochures in them. Those are examples of the brochures that we print and produce and hand out to consumers. And they come in large part from information that we get from consumers about problems that they're seeing in the marketplace. Jan also participates in special programs. She traveled all over the state this fall with seniors and people with disabilities and its Medicaid fraud team speaking at senior centers on scams targeting seniors.
Oregon, if the committee hasn't heard Jan speak, you should, members of the committee haven't heard Jan speak. She is a dynamic individual who is a wonderful speaker who provides a great deal of information to your constituents. Should you ever have the opportunity to do that, it is a good presentation and entertain all of us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that she's probably the heart and soul of our section in a lot of ways. Also, we work with the Oregon Consumer Protection Agencies. The agencies in that group are listed on the board there. We organize this group to jointly participate in educational programs and to share expenses. There's a magnet in your materials that lists that we produce that jointly. It's phone numbers for all of those agencies. We run a state fair booth every year. And currently we're working on, it's called the SUGWIA. It's a state directory of services. It's in newspaper tabloid format, written half in Spanish, half in English. It was last published in 1996. We are targeting a July 03 date for the revised publication. It contains a state directory of every state agency, consumer protection contact, and phone numbers. It's to be distributed through the state agencies, especially the Employment Division and Seniors and Persons with Disabilities. These joint projects are good because they save money. We all chip in to print them. They're more effective because we leverage off everyone's expertise, and we also capitalize on the distribution channels of all participating agencies in getting this information out. Other examples of education, the Car Dealer Advisory Committee, that's run by the Department of Motor Vehicles. We're a public member. It includes car dealers and representatives from the manufactured housing industry, salvage yards, tow companies. The purpose of it is that the industry advises the agency of issues and problem areas. Our role on that committee is to be the voice of consumers in developing solutions. We provide training. I provided training to auto mechanics in 2002, did a 6-class series in Portland, then Eugene, and Salem. What we did was we took the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, we translated it according to the sections that most often come up in that industry, and then we provided educational written materials and oral presentation to educate them about the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, how it applies to the way that they do business.
Chair. Representative Butler.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Ms. Pellegrini, one item, and I appreciate the work that's being done with regard to education prevention. I see the Car Dealer Advisory Committee, you say, is actively involved. And the cases involving, amongst the 10 areas of highest complaints, 2001 and 2002, under 1,000 complaints in the automobile area. Well, look at the telecommunications. And having just recently been slammed and crammed, I'm kind of sensitive about this right now. Our office and our home and various other places in eastern Oregon got attached to our various bills some things that we didn't particularly appreciate and subscribe to signed up for. That being the case, why don't we have a telecommunications advisory committee? I mean, if I've got 5 times the case number than I do with the automobile, and figuring out that it's either my AT&T bill or one of those others, these are big companies in the state of Oregon that we could have pitch in and put together an advisory. Has that ever been considered? For that appears to be the preponderance of the cases, 3,500 this past year.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, you're right. That is the preponderance of the cases. Here's the thing. With the Car Dealer Advisory Committee, those are all entities that are licensed by the Department of Motor Vehicles, and that is a standing committee within the Department of Transportation, Department of Motor Vehicles. It's been a long-standing committee. With telecommunications, the Public Utilities Commission regulates some but not all telecommunications companies. And I'll tell you, the companies that are doing most of the slamming, some of them are large companies, but a lot of them are really small, like they're in Oklahoma, they're in Missouri. They buy blocks of long-distance time on the air time, and then they'll just slam a bunch of people.
Mr. Chair, I don't mean to be disrespectful nor in any way argumentative, but I would say this, that when it's my local telephone company bill that is, and my local telephone company is giving these companies, which, as far as I'm concerned, are performing illegally in the state of Oregon, when and these are all regulated companies. They're either regulated or they're municipally owned companies, a telephone company or a power company or other regulated entity. I guess I'm looking at that and saying, wait a minute. Those folks, whether it's AT&T or Verizon or whomever, or U.S. West Quest, I guess it's now, they have a lot at stake. And I would think that at some point the Attorney General and staff would become somewhat anxious over the fact that you've got five times the number of claims and complaints involving a specific area, and I'm wondering what's being done to draw those folks to the table, because they're using a legitimate company's billing process to bill Oregonians.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we introduced Senate Bill 120. Hopefully you'll be seeing that this session. It's a bill that targets slamming. It gives the Attorney General's office specific authority to go after companies that slam. It sets up a tiered level of civil penalties that we can seek. But more importantly, the reason that a lot of people are slammed is because it's done through telemarketing, and people don't understand that in answering what seem to be rather benign questions, they're actually agreeing to having their telephone long-distance service changed. What Senate Bill 120 would do is it would require a telecommunications company, before it changes your service, to make several very clear disclosures. The other thing that it would do is it would prohibit a telemarketer from peering an offer to change your long-distance service with any sort of prize, promotion, sweepstakes, or any sort of offer like that, because that's where we see, that's one of the methods that we've seen telemarketers use the most. That's what we're doing about it, because we're a law enforcement agency. We're not a regulatory agency like the Public Utilities Commission.
Well, I still think it's an excellent opportunity for us to draw these folks together, because I really don't think that it's appropriate that the PUC is regulating companies that are authorizing their billing process to be turned over to criminals. And I look at that and I say, wait a minute, isn't your office a batch of lawyers that are supposed to zero in on that criminal activity? So I appreciate the slamming discussion, but my concern is that what it's doing is it's giving some legitimate companies in Oregon a terrible black eye by allowing this activity to continue in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Identity Theft Working Group. This is a collaboration of state and federal criminal and civil law enforcement entities, including the Secret Service, the Social Security Administration, Office of the Inspector General, the United States Attorney's Office, district attorneys from Multnomah and Clackamas counties, the Department of Justice, Civil Enforcement, or Financial Fraud and Criminal Justice Division, Oregon State Police, and local jurisdictions, as well as state agencies, credit reporting agencies, financial institutions, and the Retail Industry Association. The thrust of this group has been to analyze gaps in current laws that impede the investigation and prosecution of identity theft, to develop best practices for both government and the private sector in handling personal information, and develop educational materials for both businesses and consumers. Three attorney general bills reflect our work in this working group. They're House Bill 2119. That would add identity theft to the Oregon RICO statutes as a predicate offense. House Bill 2105 that would authorize or allow Oregonians to get one free credit report per year in order to check their credit reports to look for suspicious activity. That's a prevention bill. House Bill 2103 would require merchants to obliterate all but the last four digits on a either credit or debit card receipt in order to protect the holder's account number. We also operate a DOJ webpage. There's information up there, and as noted on the slide, we average about 4,000 hits per month to that webpage. Talked about education, let's turn to enforcement. Talk about complaints. Our enforcement actions are based on information received from a number of sources. Complaints are one of those sources. We receive complaints from the consumer hotline, referrals from state agencies, from your constituents, from you and your staff. The slide shows how these complaints move through our office. They come in. We have five enforcement officers that handle all of the written complaints right now. Their function is to determine whether or not the complaint alleges a pattern or practice of activity, or does it just allege something that's an isolated incident. In developing these cases, they have lots of contact with both consumers and businesses, and they attempt to informally resolve individual complaints. This right here is a choke point, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. As a result of the written complaints, some of those result in enforcement actions, and those are handled by 10 attorneys and 6 investigators. Those enforcement actions, in turn, are resolved either through settlement, assurance of voluntary compliance, filing of a lawsuit, or some cases are closed. They're closed because the business goes out of business. They're closed because the business goes bankrupt. They're closed because there's insufficient evidence as a result of our investigation to substantiate a law violation. Or sometimes what we find is that there's no evidence of a law violation at all, but just a bad business practice. This is the top 10 area of consumer complaints. We run these every February. We've given you just 2001 and 2002 so you can compare them. They are not necessarily an indicator of where we devote most of our enforcement resources, but they do reveal trends and form the basis for some of our educational material. Just a couple of things. As Representative Butler noted, telecommunications is a persistent problem for us. And I mentioned Senate Bill 120. I will note, too, that construction contractors are off the list in 2001 and 2002. It's the first 2 years this has happened. And we believe it's in large part due to the success of a joint enforcement program between the Construction Contractors Board and Department of Justice that was forged as a result of the last legislative session. The Construction Contractors Board agreed to fund one full-time attorney position and one support staff that we could use to target construction fraud. So far, we've had 56 referrals of cases over from the Contractors Board, and since July 01, we've obtained judgments or assurances against 26 contractors under that program. Program growth. As you can see, calls to the hotline continues to increase. It's almost three times in 2002 what it was in 1999. Written complaints also continue to increase. Those five enforcement officers handled 17,405 complaints in 2002. They either did a referral on them, they opened it, actively handled the cases, or they referred those cases to attorneys or investigators for further development. Of those,
Representative Hansen has a question.
Quick question. On these top 10 areas of complaints, for example, I'm looking at the Nigerian money transfer, which I've been solicited several countless times, and other than being annoying spam, I'm not about really to send them all my bank information. But for something like that, obviously, we're not going to. The number of complaints that you get really are just an, I wouldn't think you'd be doing a lot of investigations on that unless somebody had actually sent money and you're trying to recover. So when we see that 1,100 people complain, is that because they were just concerned in terms of something that looks like a pretty obvious fraud, or was that 1,100 people that actually sent bank information or lost money?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, no. Most of them were people that received the email or the fax or the letter, became concerned and contacted us. But there are some people, and in fact there was there's a professional in Portland that lost over $200,000. There's a state office worker who lost over $120,000. She cashed out her retirement account, traveled to England, and thought that she was dealing with not a legitimate business opportunity, but certainly a credible business opportunity. So only a fraction of the contacts there have been from victims. But a lot of people, we do, even though they haven't been victims, a lot of those contacts, we respond back. So the enforcement officer will generate a letter and take the time to respond to them.
Carol, can you tell us, as we look at your program growth piece, can you tell us the number of attorneys that you've had since 1995 through 2002? I mean, it just seems like, based upon, you know, I'd like to know the attorneys and investigator staff, because you have 10 attorneys for this division, and I know that some of the cases are highly complex cases that take a lot of time. It seems a little, if you can expand upon that.
Sure. Mr. Chair, we currently have, we picked up one attorney in the last session as a result of that Construction Contractors Board arrangement. So I think that it's been static at 9 attorneys. I'll have to go back and check. I started with the section in 1995, and we either had 8 or 9 attorneys then. So I don't think that we've picked up more than one attorney, and we've picked up one investigative position, but that position also services family law in investigating and working up those termination of parental rights cases. That's static, and that explains why we're capped out as far as the number of investigations and prosecutions that we can manage. You're never going to see us go above about 300, and in fact, it dropped down in 2002 for the very reason that you just identified. We're doing mergers, and we're doing large, complex antitrust cases, and we're doing cases involving pharmaceutical companies.
Mayor George.
Thank you, Cheryl, because I was looking at that same thing, saying, what's wrong with the fact we have 3 times as many hotline calls and we're actually less? You're saying that basically is inability to meet it. Why would we then solicit people to notify us if we can't do something for them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Senator George, because it's important for us to know about what's going on out in the community, so that our hope is that we can recognize the worst abuses and stop them. We can't address everything that's going on in the marketplace, but to the extent that we can address the worst and stop the biggest harm, that's why we always want people to contact us.
Imagine their number of volunteers has probably gone up over the years.
Mr. Chair, actually, we had a high of 70, and then we had to reorganize our office space, and so we lost some. And it also depends on, you know, people come and go on vacations and stuff like that. These are current factors affecting our driving our demand for services. We expanded the hotline from 4 to 8 hours a day in April of 2000. That, in addition to running a toll-free hotline, we started that in July 99, has driven up the number of complaints that we've received. There was a 6,000 complaint increase between 2000 and 2001. Between 2001 and 2002, it's a 5,000 complaint increase. In addition, we began online complaint filing in April of last year. We're averaging 14 complaints a day. That means that you can just click on the website, file a complaint, submit it. You don't have to download and send it in. We've not advertised this feature because we fear that it's going to result in just another surge of complaints, a lot like the rise we saw when we started the hotline. There's been an increased demand for bilingual services. We added one enforcement officer as a result of the last budget cycle, last biennium, and we now have two bilingual, bicultural enforcement officers. They handle all Spanish-speaking consumer cases in addition to their regular share of cases. I would note also that a recent article noted that Oregon's population, according to the 2000 census, is now comprised 8% of Latino. Telecommunications, you know, we become increasingly more dependent on telecommunications services, local and long distance, wireless, cell phones, internet service providers, cable and satellite services. Those all comprise the sorts of telecommunications cases we're seeing. Oregon is among the top three wired cities in the United States. That means that the number of persons on the internet, that drives up the number of internet-related complaints. Internet auctions were number 4, and internet retailers were number 8 in the 2002 top 10 list. Also, as I mentioned, we're doing more antitrust merger and conduct cases, not the least of which is the electricity pricing and supply case, which is looking into the collapse of the California energy market and its effect on Oregon ratepayers. Looking into the future, these are the factors that we think are going to continue to drive an increased need for our services. Again, 2000 census reports that 21.7% of Oregon residents are over the age of 65. We are seeing an increase in cases involving health-related products and services. Increase here, we're guessing, is going to be tied somewhat to the increase in aging population, but also to the explosion of direct-to-consumer advertising of drugs, that plus unprecedented competition among drug manufacturers to create, capture, and maintain the demand for drugs that they're marketing. Example of this is the Pfizer case. That's involved the marketing of Zithromax. We recently settled that case, but very large case as a direct result of direct-to-consumer advertising. And I would note that that case, we were the lead state. It resulted in a $6 million settlement, and half a million of that went back to Oregon for our costs and as a deterrent. We will continue to see an increase in demand for bilingual services, and also the Federal Communication, the Federal Trade Commission is talking about instituting a national do-not-call telephone solicitation registry. That would be free. And we expect if that happens, currently we have 110,000 people signed up for Oregon's no-call. We expect that that will go up to the millions. And commensurate with that, we're going to see an increase in the number of no-call complaints.
Chairman?
Senator Devlin.
Just a quick question on the no-call. Is there, on the state no-call, and I know there's a proposal actually in a bill here to expand that to businesses also, the business customers. Are there exclusions in that in terms of parties that, I'm wondering how many of the complaints are generated by legitimate people that are making calls where they shouldn't be, and how many of them are actually exclusions to the law? Are there actually, I understand there are some exclusions to the law about.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, you mean to Oregon's law?
Right.
There are 5 exclusions. And I would say, we get over 1,000 no-call complaints. I would say 5% or less are from companies who actually fit one of the exemptions. Now, we don't prosecute each and every one because if we only receive one complaint, no-call violation, we usually send a warning letter. Th- This is where we get the resources to run the section. We're 35% general funded, 65% other funded. Those other funds are a direct result of the enforcement actions that we take. And those funds are placed into the Consumer Protection and Education Revolving Account. Policy package, what we are seeking this biennium is to add one enforcement officer, one support staff. That's as a direct result of the 24% increase in the written complaints that we've received. This has resulted in an increased delay between the time we get the complaints and in time an enforcement officer can start working on them. Sometimes currently it can be up to 7 weeks before an enforcement officer gets to the case. Funding the positions will provide those benefits. How we'll measure success.
Cheryl?
Yes.
If we were to fund those positions, do you still anticipate the same split, 35-65?
Mr. Chair, I do. That's been pretty consistent. It's ranged, I think, from 41-59% to 35-65. So, yes, I do.
You spend down the fund balance, the Consumer Protection Fund. Can you tell me, I mean, what's the cash flow? Do that look like? Do we spend it down? Do you have an idea on that, Doug?
No. We'll have to get some information.
I'd just like to get some information on what's in the fund, how much is expended. I mean, I know it's going to vary. I know it varies pretty substantially. So
we actually have that information. They supply it for us before we provided the policy package, and so they can probably give you the same information.
Okay. I'd just like to take a look at that.
The policy package, Mr. Chair, is not general fund, of course. It's out of that consumer protection fund.
So the entire piece is out of that
fund? Yes.
That was the expectation, yeah. And what we wanted to do is make sure there's sufficient resources in the fund that not only fund it during 0305, but it's simplified.
Okay. But I'd like to take a look.
Yeah, but I can't really give you the balance.
Okay, great.
We would measure our success in applying those resources by decreasing the time to respond to consumer complaints. It also hopefully will increase the capacity of our program to handle consumer complaints, since we only expect the number of complaints to continue to rise. Not funding the positions, understandably, I think that we're going to see the delay in the time those complaints get received and worked to increase from 7 weeks to, you know, at worst 12 to 14, which is a long time. That's the consequence there is that we're going to miss complaints that we should be addressing. Unlawful conduct is going to continue, increased harm to consumers, decreased chance of successful outcome, and I think it's going to overall decrease the deterrent effect of those enforcement actions that we do bring.
Thank you, Cheryl. I would like to, Chairman, members of the committee, I would like to then now wrap up for the division as a whole. There are two performance measures that apply specifically to our division, 137-3, the amount of monies recovered from the state divided by the cost of recovery. As I mentioned previously, we recover $8 for every $1 billed out to the agencies. We felt this was a pretty darn good gauge of our efficiency, and we certainly, it's our goal to increase the amount of money we collect for the costs. And since this is the first time we've actually had this particular performance measure, we'll see how we do through the years. The second one is 137-6, percentage of timely and complete charities reports submitted relative to total charities registered. We felt that this would gauge our educational effort in the charities section. That is 79%, the percentage of timely and complete charities reports submitted. Obviously, our goal is 100%, but this will certainly gauge our effort and to the extent we're getting out and getting our educational effort out there. The next slide shows our revenues by source. The
if you may want to redo the slide. It equals about 125%, actually.
They're having some rounding here.
Maybe it's that other revenue portion that I couldn't ever figure out.
Can we, while we have a real quick break, I know Connie's here. I don't think we're going to get to your stuff, so I don't, unless this is instructive for you. I'm not going to hold you to waiting. I know that you have other things to do. So I just wanted to let you know that. Go ahead.
We have a variety of funding sources. The federal revenue funding source is the Medicaid Fraud Unit. General Fund is Medicaid Fraud and Financial Fraud. Assurances of voluntary compliance would be going to the Consumer Protection Education account. The business license and fees is what finances the charitable activities section. The bulk of the financing is through legal fees and revenues. Civil Enforcement Division consists 10% of the Department of Justice and the Governor's Balanced Budget. There is the Governor's Balanced Budget for this particular division. Personal Services consist of 75% of the Civil Enforcement Division's expenditures, services and supplies, the other 25%. We had an inflation and price adjustment. The essential packages would be $311,000. The third special session eliminated COLAs with the four managers, salary range 38 and above. There show the savings we incurred there. During the fifth special session, there was a reduction in the Medicaid fraud funding. I believe this relates to the phasing in of the positions, and we will address this in our report. My final slide has to do with the House Bill 3182 reductions. It's our 10% reduction, and we will be eliminating, and this is how we would go about a 10% reduction. We, in the three sections that are the Medicaid fraud section, the financial fraud section, and the charitable activities section, we are attempting to prioritize our missions and from the least to the greatest. The other two sections, the civil recovery section and the family law section, would have to work with their various client agencies in order to prioritize the services that they give to those client agencies. So should we be faced with the 10% reduction, what we would do is certainly try to eliminate any services and supplies that we possibly could, and then attempt a reduction based on our prioritization.
I'd like to explore, and I've told Doug this, I'd like to see with the if you'll look at the fund balances, not only in the charitable piece, but also in the financial fraud division, to see if there's some potential for backfill to remain at the current staffing levels on the general fund. Because it's not what my preference would be to do, but I certainly think in this environment we have to look at those other funds to do some backfill versus the general fund on some of those cuts to look at. So if you guys can look at the amount of money that's in the fund and what your projections may look like for the upcoming biennium, Cheryl, you obviously would have a good idea in yours if it's possible to, instead of hurting the program through staff cuts, to maybe help maintain part of that program. This division just has so, I mean, the department as a whole has so little general fund in it that we're trying to do what we can do. Representative Hanson.
See, I just gave a major budget thing and you're out of the room. So.
Well, in the same vein, when we look, and I think this came up this morning in Transportation Economic Development, when we look at the reductions for the inflation, the personnel inflation costs throughout the year, okay, some are general fund positions, which clearly means is a savings to the general fund. Then you've got other funded positions. And it seems to me that it seems kind of counterintuitive that we would be using, in some cases, the other funds pay for performance and pay for what the department or agency is doing. By holding the salaries in check and not get that we'd simply use those funds to either lower rates or lower transfers or something, it would seem to me this would be an opportunity to somehow capture those dollars and use them for the backfilling in general fund.
Capture which dollars?
The other fund savings that we're going to have by holding personnel costs flat. If they're other funded positions.
And I think that's what I think the co-chairs are still trying to get their arms around that. I'm just like, I've been instructed looking for savings in the department. I think that major salary issue and how those costs will be allocated in terms of what we're looking for is the substantial savings that we need to focus on. Any other questions for this particular division? All right.
Thank you.
Byron? I'm going to go to my plan is to go till 3:30. I know Representative Butler has to go to the PERS meeting, which is also where a substantial amount of savings maybe will approve this by any order. So go forth and do good deeds,
Representative Butler. We
appreciate it. And I appreciate the rest of the committee's indulgence to continue to stay through 3:30. We're, as you know, we're on tight timeline, so I'm going to shut up. And Byron was one of the people who did some of my initial training when I was first a baby deputy DA. So and most of what he taught me worked. Some of you did.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Byron Chatfield. I'm chief counsel of the Criminal Justice Division for the Oregon Department of Justice. I will be addressing two of our sections, and Connie Gallagher, who is director of the Crime Victims Assistance section, will be addressing that particular area. Up before you right now is an organizational structure of the division, and I'm going to address, as I mentioned to you, the District Attorney Assistance section and the Organized Crime section. I would only point out that the Western States Information Network up there is a federally funded narcotics information network that's housed in the division. Other services that we provide are to the Department of Public Safety standards and training for revocation of officer certification. We also do Oregon State Police provide general counsel to them for forfeiture action. And we also provide assistance support to the Secretary of State's office for the investigation and prosecution of election law cases. And I'll be talking about that in a little more detail in a couple of minutes. The District Attorney Assistance section, the mission of that particular section is to consult, advise, and assist district attorneys in prosecutions and in their law enforcement responsibilities. There are four general program areas that we address, and that's the core function of basically the public safety provision dealing with district attorney assistance. And let me go into a little bit of detail about those. As a former district attorney myself and coming from a small county, I can verify that the services that are provided by this section are really crucial. And I've highlighted that up there a little bit as far as it relates to the small and medium-sized counties, because that's where the real impact that our service provides is to those particular counties. Typical cases that we've had, we have an assistant attorney general assisting with the Longo case down in Lincoln County that involved the death of the mother and the children. But I think even more so as far as an example is one in Sherman County where we had a newly elected district attorney who doesn't have any criminal experience at all called up and said, hey, I need assistance because I have a major 11 sex abuse involving a child. And they've never done a case like that before, and we've assigned a prosecutor prosecutor to work with her in doing that particular case. Another example is in Curry County, where in over a two-year period of time, they've had four aggravated murder cases in that particular office. And so we're fungible in the sense that we go to different areas, down in Curry County in one instance, in Sherman County in another. And those are types of cases where we have provided trial assistance. They're usually time-consuming and resource-intensive, but it's those types of services that smaller and medium-sized counties just do not have the resources, expertise, or experience in those particular areas. The investigative and trial support services, I want to point out one thing. First of all, we do not duplicate, we don't compete with, or we replace law enforcement. What we do here is we provide the resources that are not available in those particular counties. And I guess really what I'm doing is focusing in on several different areas, one of which is areas of financial investigation assistance. We are the only office in the state of Oregon outside of one criminal financial investigator that is with the Portland Police Bureau that provides criminal financial investigative assistance to law enforcement and to district attorneys. So anytime you have paper types of cases, white-collar crimes, they call us because we have the CPA types to go out and work on those particular cases. We also have experienced homicide detectives who provide the assistance basically in aggravated murder cases, working on those phases that deal with the penalty aspect of death penalty. After the initial investigation, then that is when we provide that assistance. And I have to say, with cutbacks with Oregon State Police, that service even is eroding away, that they need assistance even in the front end now in many cases. And we're starting to get phone calls there. Let me address the other areas, training and publications that we provide. What we try to do is make sure that we don't have 36 separate interpretations in law and procedure around the state, that it's cohesive, and that what is happening in, let's say, Lake County is the same thing that's happening in Multnomah County, that we're consistent in the approach that we take. And there's a particular reason why we do that, and that's to make sure that we don't have bad law made, things that go up on appeal, retrials, and it's basically to make sure that it's one voice that is speaking as it relates to legal issues. We provide the only statewide training for prosecutors. And when I say that, what we do is we gear our training specifically for prosecutors. It doesn't deal with civil practitioners at all. It deals strictly with prosecutors. And we do that in primarily our what we call our annual institute. There's a basic program that we have, and that's really, as Mr. Chair, you mentioned, it's for the beginning prosecutor who just comes into prosecution, and we give them basically the nuts and bolts of how you handle cases in court and the prosecution. We also then have the advanced course, and that's where it's complex cases. We deal with different areas. It may be child abuse. It may be we've done those on death penalty cases, financial crimes, more of the sophisticated types of cases. The publications that we have. Again, we get back down to the nuts and bolts, and that's really what we give, is just the nuts and bolts, one of which and one of the primary ones that we provide is this manual right here. This is just search and seizure here in the state of Oregon. And someone will say, well, why do you have such a large book like this? Well, one of the problems we have, I guess, here in Oregon is that, and maybe I shouldn't say a problem, because we're unique in a certain sense. We're independent. And we have different rules that relate to search and seizure that they have with the Supreme Court in the United States and what the federal authorities deal with in other states. We have some unique aspects of that. And that's what becomes really critical that we stay on top of. And we try to do that in all of the areas of law, but search and seizure is one that has become really a crucial area that police officers and prosecutors deal with on a day-to-day basis. Phone calls in the middle of the night, and they got a car stopped out on the highway, and here is the fact situation. I know that, Mr. Chair, you've had those experiences.
They do them annually. I have two of those that are they look like they got coffee in their own
dog-eared.
They're dog-eared and worn right. out, and the spine's broken, and the whole bit. So.
That's right. That's
Believe
right.
me, they get used.
The other things that we do also is we have Oregon Criminal Reporter, which is a digest of criminal cases and tips and that sort of thing. And we also do the indictment form book. The indictment form book comes out after each session, and in any new laws, we come up with forms and to make sure that it's consistently used throughout the state. And that's kind of the nuts and bolts. There's one thing on the chart that I want to talk about, and I glanced over a little bit, and that's the governor's directive. One of the issues that we've run into in the district attorney assistants is that when we have a vacancy, or such as I have up there, Grant County, there was a district attorney that was recalled. The governor has the authority to direct us to go in and run an office, and that's what we did in Grant County for 11 months. Now, that means running the whole office, handling all of the cases, any issue that comes up. And that was a tremendous, you know, job to do, to go in and run everything. Our primary core function has been handling death penalty cases, these serious cases for the counties. This was one where there was no one else. We were directed to go in and do that. And we've done that in several cases now, not just in Grant County. That was for 11 months. We've done it in Jefferson County, I know. We've done it in Wheeler County. We've been down in Curry County where there, for some reason, there's a vacancy in the office, and we've gone in and we've done that job. One of the things I think that's extremely important, and one of the things that we focus in on when I mentioned about training and publications, is that we try to make sure that there are no legal mistakes. We try to avoid retrials. We try to avoid appeals, and that's really the focus. And we feel in the short, we look at it in the long run, that's going to save funds. And we really put an emphasis on that, besides reducing, you know, tort liability or that sort of thing. The next slide just gives you an idea of the counties where we have open and active cases from July 01 up until this February, just to give you a variety of where we're at and where we actually have cases that are ongoing. That's district attorney assistance in a nutshell. Now I want to turn, if I could, to organized crime. And there's a couple of things that I want to point out. First of all, our mission in dealing with organized crime is to prevent the infiltration of organized crime in the state. We're to combat organized crime. And really what that comes down to is this, is that we investigate, we prosecute individuals, entities that are engaged in organized crime or official corruption. And I'll deal with that separately, but that's basically the mission in a nutshell, what we're involved in. Now, always a question that comes up. Well, what do you mean organized crime? You and I know that when we talk about organized crime, well, we think of The Godfather, we think of The Sopranos. But I'm here to tell you that, yes, that is organized crime, but we have a somewhat larger definition of organized crime when we deal with it here in Oregon. And it's statutory, and I've got the statute up there, but the bottom line is that we're dealing with criminal activity where somebody's having a significant source of income from criminal activity. Two or more people that are involved in this, aiding and abetting, it's a significant source, or we're involved in drugs, prostitution, theft, those sorts of things. But what is really unique is the other aspect of it deals with the corruption of police or public officers or employees. And I'll talk about that, as I said, in just a second. But we approach organized crime here in various ways. What we end up doing is we look at it from conventional crime. We look at it going after it that way. We also look at it in the context of going after it on the basis of racketeering. And we look at that, we try to take the profit out of crime, because isn't that what organized crime really is? It deals in profit. It's a money-making. It's a business. It's an enterprise. So we go after those enterprises and try and take the profit out of it, and also to cripple any criminal organization. Plus, if we deal with racketeering, we're looking at more enhanced or greater enhanced sentences. So those are some things that we look at. Let me give you just a couple of examples. There was a group of people, and we prosecuted one already, and we have some things outstanding on several other people, so I'm not going to go into details, but what we did have was the defrauding of the Oregon Department of Revenue through an elaborate scheme of tax evasion. And we worked in conjunction with the Department of Revenue, and I feel that we were very successful, but it was a large, group of people that were committing these particular crimes, but they were defrauding basically through a tax scheme, and it was done by an accountant. Another case was defrauding.
Lieutenant Butler's not here.
Yeah, he's not here. That's why we tripled the fees.
I'm not even going to address down that path. Another case that we had was the defrauding of fishermen over on the coast. And it was by a company that over there that was involved in basically, and it's somewhat complicated, but it was dealing with fish waybacks, dealing with fishermen bringing a profit, you know, fish in and waybacks. And basically they were being defrauded. They were cheated. And the state was cheated out of that. And there was a considerable amount of work that had to be done. Oregon State Police worked on that. We worked on that particular case. And out of that came one of the largest financial assessments in a criminal case here in Oregon. It was paid not only back to the fishermen, but also back to the community, because it was an economic loss to the community, and that was important for us to recover that for the community. Another one involved an administrator, a company that was administrating workers' compensation down in southern Oregon. It involved a number of counties. In fact, it was a loss of $1.6 million. It involved counties Douglas, Jackson, Josephine, and Washington counties. Considerable loss and a large type of case. All kinds of, you know, we look at white-collar crime. This was a white-collar crime that, you know, kind of blows you over when you see all of the paperwork and things that go into working those types of cases. But that's basically the approach that we've taken and the types of cases. That particular diagram up there right now is basically the crimes that we have, or the case that we have open and active from July 1 through February 03. Now, it has organized crime, but it also involves those cases dealing with official corruption or misconduct by either employees or public officers. One of the central components of the Attorney General's stance against organized crime is really rapid enforcement against public corruption. We know that all the studies show us that organized crime is successful if you have anti-corruption laws that you don't have any, they don't exist, or they're laxly applied. And our position has been, if you don't enforce them, we're going to have more organized crime. There's just no question about it. When I say more, we do have organized crime here. Maybe we don't have it as we talk about the Sopranos, but we do have organized crime. We have it in a number of different areas, whether we're talking about drugs or some of those examples that I gave. Anywhere that you have a financial gain, you're going to have organized crime. I can assure you of that. But one of the things that's unique about our particular division in this particular section is that quite often, we are the only viable entity to investigate those crimes and prosecute those. And this is the reason why I say that, is quite often the cases that we end up getting may involve a police department who happens to a police officer that happens to be working with the DA, works with all the local law enforcement, and there is no one else that they can really turn to other than ourselves. They know or depend on the suspect of the investigation, such as the police department, or we turn around and maybe it's county commissioners, and they hold the purse strings. And so it's a difficult issue. It's basically a conflict of interest that they have, and so that we're able to go in and do an independent investigation and prosecution. Now, a couple of examples. We're currently, and I can mention this because we're really just going into the sentencing. One case involved the former sheriff of Deschutes County, Greg Brown. He defrauded the sheriff's reserve account and also the Sisters Rural Fire District. And we're talking about over $500,000. That case is going to sentencing. We work with the federal FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office in that particular case, and it's going to go to sentencing next month in federal court. In conjunction with him, we work with him, and that's where it's going to be resolved. Another case was out of Klamath County, wherein we had corrections officers that were engaged in sexual activity with inmates. We were asked to go in and do the investigation on that case, follow up on the initial investigation, and we ended up prosecuting those police officers, corrections officers, for official misconduct engaging in that activity. So that's just kind of a flavor of the, when we talk about official misconduct or public corruption types of cases that we end up doing. There's a unique role that we have also, and that is basically liaison and coordination. In police work, there's usually an issue in dealing with jurisdiction and cases and sort of like, hey, this is our case, this is what we're working on. We're not in competition with any agency at all. We don't compete with them. What we end up doing in our services, we merely supplement and assist other agencies. So we're in a great, actually an excellent position to coordinate investigations and to work with other agencies, and we end up doing that. And we facilitate the exchange of information and the resolution of cases. We know that in organized crime, we know that crime doesn't occur in one county, in your county. It's across county lines. And so when we have multi-jurisdictional cases, that's what we end up focusing on, are those types of cases. Now, you saw the organizational structure, and we have different components under that. And I want to talk about those. And let me talk about the first one, and that's the Tobacco Compliance Task Force. That was set up this last legislative session. It's a joint task force. You see the names of the groups that are involved. Let me talk with you and identify specifically the federal partners. That particular task force is what we have on the federal partners is the U.S. Attorney's Office. We have U.S. Customs. We have the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and the Internal Revenue Service. They are all components of that task force and working on it. It's a model here in the state of Oregon. In fact, Assistant Attorney General Matt McCauley, who is one that's working with that task force, was requested at the expense of U.S. Customs to go back to Washington, D.C., and to explain our model that was set up by this last legislative session, because U.S. Customs believes that this is the model that should be used throughout the United States because it's working. And so that was the impetus of pursuing that. The other thing, and I want to identify...
About Assistant Attorney General Matt McCauley was trained in Jackson County, Oregon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
He happened to take over my caseload, too, when I left.
And I think he gave his to someone else when he left. So, I've identified on that slide the mission and the approach that we take. And you can read that. But what I really want to identify is what we've determined to be the problem with tobacco. And that is it's inter-county, it's interstate, and it's international. It's a problem in all of those areas. There's no question about it. It's extremely serious. Now, I talked with you about organized crime and the definition and how we have this broad definition of organized crime. That, it fits that definition, but I'm here to tell you that we also have organized crime links here in Oregon as it relates to the traditional sense with tobacco. The information that we've gathered based on the cases show that there are links into Oregon based on this type of activity. And although we don't have things directly with respect to Oregon and dealing with terrorists and things like that, we know anecdotally that sort of funding from cigarettes is also funding terrorist activity. So we are concerned about that. We're concerned because we don't know the scope and exactly get our hands on. We know we have a problem, but we don't know the extent of that problem right now, and that's one of the things that we're working on. And what do we talk about when we say cigarette tax evasion? You know, when we say, well, what are we? You know, what is it? Okay, you're buying a pack of cigarettes that doesn't have a stamp on it, and they didn't pay the tax. Well, it's a lot more than that. What it is, it's counterfeit. We're talking about counterfeit cigarettes, and we're talking about counterfeit stamps. We're talking about smuggling. That's gray market cigarettes. Gray market being those cigarettes that are supposedly sent, manufactured here, to be sent overseas, and what they end up doing, they're being brought back into our country. And in effect, they're not being taxed here, either by the state or by the federal government. They're being shipped out, smuggled back in. Or we have interstate smuggling. Smuggling from one state who has a low tax rate to our state, and they're sold here. We don't get the tax on that. And there's tremendous amounts of illegal activity. It's a $1 billion business in the world with respect to tax evasion. Now, crimes, what are we talking about? Obviously, racketeering. We got organizations that are involved in this. We talk about racketeering. We're talking about the unlawful distribution of cigarettes. We're talking about forgery. We're talking about money laundering, because as I mentioned, organized crime is nothing more than illicit business, and it's an enterprise to make money, and lots of money, and that's what they do. And also we have what's interesting under our statutes is trademark counterfeiting. That's where they turn around, you look at that pack of cigarettes, and you say, that's Marlboro's. Well, in reality, it's not.
it looks like Marlboros, but it's actually coming out of China. And you look at them, and I'll tell you right now, you're not going to be able to tell the difference unless you're trained to look at them and to see the difference. Now, what do we have here going on in this Tobacco Compliance Task Force right now? We have over 45 criminal investigations going on right now. We've already executed one search warrant. We anticipate more, although I don't know if that we'll see how that happens, but and I'll talk about that in just a second. But we're in the posture where we're going to be able to execute additional search warrants. We've indicted a business, a distributor, and we've also arrested the two owners of that particular business. That case is pending right now. And as I mentioned to you, this business with tobacco is organized and it's long existing criminal operations and organizations here in Oregon. Now, how about tobacco tax revenue? There are the figures up there with respect to the a pack of cigarettes and what the increase was. But I think what's more important is the cigarette tax revenue goal. For 2001-03, for the biennium, the amount is up there, $368.3 million. Now, that goal was not the initial goal when we started out because there was a tax increase from back in November. So that's been adjusted, and that's the new adjusted number. Now, that goal includes $8 million that was the goal of the task force activity. So when the task force was set up, there was built into that goal that this task force was going to make $8 million to include that. Now, where are we at with respect to collections? As of December 31 of 2002, we've exceeded the prorated monthly collection. But I want to underline the next portion of that is future collections are uncertain. We don't know. That can go up or go down. So when we look at a goal, yes, that's a goal after for the biennium, but we keep track of it monthly. Sometimes it's up, sometimes it's down. You know, it varies. But as a whole, where we're at as of December, we're ahead. We've exceeded the prorated monthly collection. Now, what's the cost? Well, for this next biennium, 2003-05, the biennium cost of the task force is set forth. Now, I'm going to address the Department of Justice because that's, you know, basically our component of that. That's over $700,000 for the biennium for our component of that. Now, that task force is being dismantled right now. It's going out of existence. What I want to emphasize in from our perspective is because the task force as it relates to tobacco is basically relating to revenue and making revenue, and it also involves prosecution and that sort of thing. But in the sense of the task force and tobacco, it's not one of our core functions as it relates to organized crime in the overall context of doing organized crime. It's really focusing in on us in a special area, tobacco and revenue and that sort of thing. But without the Department of Revenue and without having detectives, Oregon State Police, I'm going to tell you that the task force is not effective. It cannot be effective. We cannot be effective in this area in prosecuting and going after criminal activity. It's not going to be effective unless you have those other two players. I can tell you that right up front. It's kind of like a three-legged stool. You take away one of them, it's not going to go. Take away two, it's definitely not. And it's not going to stand there with one. And really, I'm going to say here, the option for the 2003-05 biennium is really to eliminate the DOJ task force funding of $700,000, over $700,000, I think it's $714,000. And I say that because when we took a look at reductions or things in budget, it's not going to be an effective task force. And if it's not funded totally, it's just not going to be effective. We cannot be effective. That's really what I'm saying. Without those other components, and that's really where we're at.
Byron, can I interrupt you for a second?
Sure.
Just so the committee knows sort of where the funding is for this, for the current biennium, the Department of Revenue and the State Police portions have been cut to the end of the biennium. In 2003-05, the governor's budget buys back the Department of Revenue, but does not buy back the State Police portion of it, and then DOJ has funded both this biennium and next biennium as it stands now. So one of the things I think the committee will talk about is, you know, you'll have $2 million of the $2.9 million, and should we reallocate those expenses in such a way so it works, maybe at a slightly reduced level, or do we put more money in because it's a revenue gathering
factor.
And I'm only addressing the fact of the Department of Justice and how I would view it in our function being able to function.
Representative Hansen.
Two quick questions. Could you make, if the Department of Revenue is funded and you're funded, could you make it work if we increase your budget so that you could have your own investigators without some of the other activities? You have use criminal investigators that are working for the Department of Justice and bypass the state police. Would that allow you to complete the mission?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen. Yes, it would. And the reason I hesitate about that is this. It does need the police function, criminal investigators. There's no question about that. Oregon State Police are part of that right now.
Well,
and that's the reason
I'm part of it right now.
Well, I mentioned part of it in the sense when I talk about the full, the scope of the task force itself. See, I view that the criminal investigative, the detective portion of that is a leg in this. That is a necessary leg. Now, whether we talk about Oregon State Police or whether we talk about Criminal Justice Division detectives doing that, that's a function, that's a component we need. Now, wherever that comes from, it's necessary, and it's not going to be able to survive without that leg. That's really what I'm saying. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Just that answers. The other one is I'd like to know who's responsible in terms of kind of this coordination. Who made the decisions that these are where the cuts were going to be now, and how did this funding situation of two-thirds of...
Well, it's the...
I guess my concept would be if the state police were willing to pull out of it for budget reasons, I would hate to see them involved in it to the point that, you know, we go forward into the next biennium and have a repeat of that same situation.
Just so the committee knows, it is the province of the executive branch under the 5100 cuts and under the allotment process to make those decisions. I've talked to state police. I've talked to revenue. Doug's looked at it for me. We have to decide what kind of policy statement or during our funding cycle for the upcoming biennium that we want to make, and I think state police also has some valid arguments as to why they chose to pull out of this particular task force to put their investigators in other things. We will have that discussion.
I guess the other technique would be to put the $2.9 million in one agency's budget and then let them have the funds and then let them hire the help that they need to make the task force work, but that way that we're not dealing with three different agencies and having three different agencies responsible for funding the same mission and then have confusion and potentially wasting of two-thirds of the effort because one chooses not to go forward.
Senator George.
Well, you see me rubbing my head because I'm still trying to figure out when we're the sixth highest in the nation and $368 million worth of revenue and something that is so easy to do. You guys remember during the debate that we talked about a single run to, I believe it was Wyoming, buying the cigarettes legally. They were paying their tax, bringing them back was over $500,000. You know, now you've got to figure out a way to distribute them, but I mean, there's no... Seriously, I mean, I just looked at that and thought, oh my gosh, the potential is there when you're the sixth highest in the nation and it's this much money. I think your group, this is going to have to, we're going to be on top of this.
Okay.
It's such big dollars.
Barnes, because we've gone late today, I'm going to ask you to either wrap this up in the next 2 minutes or else we'll just continue with it tomorrow, whatever your preference would be.
I think I can wrap it up. Okay, this portion up. I would just move on. I wanted to point that out with respect to budget that situation and the necessity of those three. The next one slide deals with the reduction in consequences. I want to point out just a couple of things, and I believe that, this was Senator George's comment dealing with the amount of money and the loss of tax revenue. That estimate, and you see the figures up there, it goes from $10 to $101 million annually. The reason for that is this. First of all, it's hard to get a handle on this, exactly how much money we're talking about. The $10 million is a very conservative, and that was a figure that the Department of Revenue came up with, looking at this and trying to be conservative and making some determination. And that came out, I believe, the last legislative session, we thought, all right, what figures are we really talking about? That's the $10 million. The $101 million is the figure that comes from Philip Morris and the studies that they've done, and they base that on contraband, what they believe is the amount of contraband cigarettes out there. That's the figure. So you know, from one extreme, you're going up here to the other one. Now, it's somewhere in between, you know, and we're not sure exactly where. Now, what do we talk about when we say lost revenue? The figure that I have up there, the over $900,000, that was the amount that has been discovered and was actually billed to distributors by the auditor. That's the Department of Revenue employee. The actual auditor that went into some businesses, distributorships, did the audits, and that's just for a 10-month period, determined that they were not paying their full share that they should be, and basically send them a bill. Now, the way that this system works, if they believe that there's criminal activity or there's some indication with revenue agents out there, if they believe there's criminal activity, then that goes to the detectives, and that's what we follow up on. And so right here is just strictly from the civil point, the administrative side of it, and the recovery. Now, I say recovery in the sense they've been billed. I don't know if they actually paid that money right now or not, but it's been billed. The other part of that is the master settlement agreement impact. You're familiar with that. The part that I want to emphasize is not only enforcement, but the fact that the participating manufacturers, if their market share is reduced, then that means less money, less revenue to the state, because that's what it's based upon. And that becomes critical, because when you turn around and you say, well, Philip Morris up there is turning around saying, you've got 40% contraband in the state of Oregon, that's what our estimates are, then the question comes down, well, if that's 40% contraband and there's a percentage that's not being paid, you know, if that's cutting into our market share, you know, that equates into what are we getting paid under the master settlement agreement. And they kind of correlate that way. So it gives you a perspective, at least.
You got to smoke specific market share brands in order to.
That's the crucial part.
That's your homework for today.
And I just put up there, you know, what happens if the continual criminal distribution of the product, tobacco products, and really what we have is organized crime is going to operate unabated. What's happening right now is just going to continue. We're certain of that. Now, I've directed my comments only to cigarettes, because another portion of that, which is much more difficult to get our hands around, is other tobacco products, chewing tobacco and things like that. And the information we have right now is that there's a significant tax loss right there over the same area. And I haven't mentioned this, but I'll just end it with this. I mentioned about sales, you know, about smuggling and things like that. Internet is a real problem. It's a serious problem, and that's why it becomes so important for us to have federal partners with the U.S. Customs and U.S. Attorney's Office to be able to work on them, mm-hmm. because you're dealing with international interstate and international groups. So that's why it's critical to work with them, and we've got a great working relationship. That's where I talk about the liaison and cooperation that we have with law enforcement agencies. That's what part of our role, and it's working with these federal agencies and state agencies, and it's a large problem. So I would end it there, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Byron. Any further questions? All right. We will be adjourned then until tomorrow.
Party construct.